Now, you may well remember that recently I had a mini rant slash sad ramble about the tragedy that is the slow death of the Imperial Guard regiments. Also, spoiler warning, this intro is quite rambly, so sorry to the three people that don't like that. I'm listening to the majority today, and the Sleep Club don't care either way, so think on that. Anyway, as I talked about the regiments recently at length, I won't repeat myself heavily about that, but the TLDR is the regiments of the Guard were always the heart and soul of the Imperium. They helped to make it feel this broad empire of different human cultures that collectively were doing all they could to stem the tide of Xenos horror and warp nightmares. Now, it's just Cadia, Krieg, maybe a little Cadishan, and yes, rumours about Cadishan could be next for an update, given that they've got their foot in the door, they've had several special characters, so it feels perhaps right that that might be on the cards. Now, surely nobody would complain about the epic Krieg updates. They were indeed fantastic. Nor the emergence of the Dawn tank, which, let me tell you, is one of the best tanks in terms of building they've ever produced. It is a joy and easy to build that tank. None of which changes the fact that the once very flavorful Guard now feel a little hollow. Now, my journey with 40k began in an era of 40k that was louder, stranger, far brighter and more vivid than it was grimdark, and certainly more than it would become. It was a time of blood reds and sunburst yellows, checkerboard patterns, goblin green, and of course, bolt pistols the size of a man's torso. Second edition was what I grew up with, and in many ways it was a different galaxy. It didn't stand where it does now, with a slow narrative creep that discusses thousands of years of lore. But all the foundational elements were there. Most important was the fact that of the few characters who did exist, their presence alone made them legendary. Every faction had some defining character who were really that faction distilled to their purest essence, with not a Primarch in sight. For the Dark Angels, you had Azrael. Blood Angels, Mephiston or Dante. For the Ultramarines, Khalgar. The Eldar had more than most to choose from. The Tau, thankfully, didn't exist. And the Orcs, of course, had Ghazghal and Makari. To put it another way, it was the age of cardboard dreadnoughts, miniatures that would break as soon as you looked at them, and vortex grenades that were just as likely to kill the thrower and their squad as much as they might the enemy. Flame templates and terminators that couldn't be killed. It really was a joyous time. But at the heart of the Imperial Guard, there was one main figure. Not Macarius, it was Commissar Yarak. When I was about 10 years old, there were but a handful of 40k friends to hobby with me, and between us, we focused on our faction of choice. My brother had the Angels of Death, a friend of mine were always Xenos, be it Orc or Tyranid, I had the Ultras, and some Chaos Space Marines, and another friend had the Imperial Guard. And without exception, it was all about Commissar Yarak. He was the centre of that army, and that was something I saw repeated among many people's armies. I don't think it's too much to say that he was factionally defining. I really feel that that was the case. Because Yarak wasn't just some glib sergeant. He wasn't an anonymous interchangeable officer or some wacky meme character like Marbo. Yet he retained the madness of that era, with his giant clenched power claw defying all physical practicality, his bionic eye and raging bloody will. Yarak, much like Dante, would endure the additions and time, not because he was grounded or in any way realistic. In fact, I think his legacy endured for the longest time because he wasn't. He represented that thing that I've spoken about so very often, the obviously absurd insanity of 40k, the mad, grim darkness, the bleak humour of a galaxy consumed by war fought at every stratified level, the stuff that is clear and obvious and very much embraced because it's awesome. But that paired with the Guard's defiant essence of humanity's just refusal to die made Yarak larger than life by his own aesthetic. And so even as the lore grew darker and denser with new alien factions, Yarak remained. He was the bulwark against the Terror, a relic of an older Imperium, but a linchpin that in many ways defined 40k, even for decades to come. Now, I admit, this might all seem overly nostalgic, rose-tinted romanticising, but I really think that it's not, because what it is to simply understand that those characters from that age carried forward because they represented this core of what 40K is all about. The despair, the hopelessness for humanity. It's what makes, or made, 40K so intriguing. Figures of legend screaming into the void. Elite squads, characters, and regiments completing the unthinkable, only to then be eliminated by the Imperium itself. And just as with the regiments and humanity, for that matter, they must remain. Because when we lose that heart and the soul of humanity, you're just left with the cold atrocity of the Imperium. Yarrick wasn't just another character to be retired, and yet that's what happened. And in the most flippant way possible. Just what was going on with Yarrick had been ambiguous for the longest time, but I would have thought that after decades of presence at the heart of the Imperial Guard, the very least one would have expected for him would be for his journey to conclude with some kind of demise or disappearance that would hit so hard it would resonate and mark the collective memory. If he was truly believed dead, his name would be carved into the planet of Armageddon and a shrine to him upon Terra itself. Or depending on how bleak you want to think, perhaps maybe not. But instead, in the latter half of 2022, a community article boiled down to, yeah, maybe he's dead, we're not sure, but he's definitely gone. And so overnight, a legend of the Imperium disappeared. Now, why did I not make a video immediately at that point in time, Lutin? Fair question. The answer is, because very often I don't like to immediately react to things, because when the dust settles and things move forward a little, these things can kind of expand and open up and be a bit better informed, especially when it comes to the lore. Now, I honestly expected some kind of campaign or scenario that was going to follow along and expand upon this. That's kind of why I thought they mentioned it. I didn't think that a 2-minute article would be how Yarrick crashed out of the 40K lore, because a year became two, and time goes very quickly, and then here we are. Yarrick being written out of the lore in a community post is a disgrace, and although they created a little lore contextual document for it, it amounted to nothing more than, yeah, so basically Yarrick's dead, glory to the Emperor. He deserved a lot more than that. A final campaign, if not a novella. And look, just before anybody calls me out, Dorne deserves that as well. Dorne doesn't deserve like a little footnote. If he's gone, they could write some kind of novella which deals with that. But they haven't done so. And admittedly, the article did go out of its way to highlight that he might not be dead, and given the status of lore canonicity, having him return would be definitely feasible. However, to come back to Dorne again, remember what my main point is about Dorne? The real problem here is not about characters dying or not dying or whatever. Maybe they thought it was cute to retire Yarrick to Legends and just give a little what if on the way out. Fine. But similarly to Dorne, it wasn't much of a what if. They provided this visual piece of Imperial documentation basically stating he's dead. And my whole thing with the lore is, if you have that and you don't have anything else, that's kind of what you have to lean toward. So while, as is true in 40K and as is true with Dorne, we can do gymnastics to rationalise his return, and that is just how it is, whether you like it or not, the problem is, once you start doing this all the time, with characters going and maybe they're not gone and maybe they are and then they come back, suddenly your narrative has become a soap opera. And that's my point about characters being dead and coming back all the time like Primarchs. It becomes this kind of daytime TV nonsense. Nothing has any kind of narrative weight anymore. Instead of a dark, gritty world that's got real consequences, you're really invested in people, it all just collapses. And that's my fundamental problem with this sort of thing. And that's a fundamental problem with other verses. And that's often what leads these things to undermine and collapse. Once you start going off into multiple realities and all these kind of things, everything falls apart because nobody cares anymore. It doesn't matter. And my classic example is whenever you have some kind of ongoing TV series or show, when a main character dies, you're like, oh, well, they're not dead. They'll come back later. And if you're not careful, if you do that often enough, that's how everything starts to feel. And then nothing has any weight to it. Nothing has any kind of narrative gravitas. And people start to disengage and they get bored because they realize, nothing really matters. At the very least, if you're going to remove such a major figure, give them a short story or a novella, something which defines more clearly their disappearance. Yarrick deserves as much, so does Dawn. So I think the situation as it stands, much like the Guard regiments, remains just unacceptable. More unacceptable, even, than releasing a new, epic-looking named Krieg commander, but giving him a Laz pistol. A Laz pistol as their primary ranged weapon. Not even some custom, ultra-precise, hotshot Laz pistol. A basic Laz pistol. I'm not letting this one go, because when I build that bloody model, I'm 100% putting a plasma pistol on him, and I don't care, or some other custom creation. Now, in saying that, people can be very passionate about any kind of change, a shortcoming, some feel passionate about just minor adjustments to stories or worlds that they're engaged with. Now, for better or worse, I generally struggle to get overtly passionate for such things the majority of the time, even with it being related to hobbies that I'm very overly invested in. It's why I don't often make videos when they announce new things for 40k, because you might imagine I'd be like foaming at the mouth. In actuality, very little gets me going for new things. Usually I just kind of like, yeah, sure, nice. Some of my top wish lists would be things like more flavor about what the Emperor is and what he's moving toward becoming. I don't think that it's something that shouldn't happen. I think we should know more there, and the situation with the Inari as well. Gilliman reuniting with the other Primarchs, we need to see that. I'd even love to see a situation where he speaks with Lorgar and so on. Basically, actually interesting things, not just a standard 40k scavenger hunt with a few battles to punctuate it. That's why call novels are so intriguing to me, because they really build out not only the character, but often the lost history of the Imperium. And a figure like Call, who is throwing the rules out the window, is particularly interesting to see jar against other things. Anyway, Yarrick. His own path is as intriguing, because he stands in many ways as a typical Imperial commander, holding the line against the horror. But he is so much more than that. Yarrick is defining of the Imperial Guard, and as I said, I think honestly, 40k itself for that matter. The Age of the Imperium is a time where unnamed heroes die by the billion, their existence forgotten before the blood dries. And to understand this is to understand the weight, power, and accomplishment of those whose names resonate throughout the centuries, if not millennia. Sebastian Yarrick would rise to become this figure of legend, but not because he was the strongest, the fastest, not even the most brilliant tactician. He endured because there was a need for him as a figure to the population of the world he defended. Yarrick allowed himself to become what the Imperium demanded, even as the cost of this hollowed him. Which to my mind always makes me think of other figures like Tyborg in the Siege of Vrax and the novel, which, I guess a little spoiler here, deals with mainly this concept of what it means to be a Krieger. And another small spoiler quote here is when he says toward the end, "We of the Krieg cannot be heroes, for heroes live forever, while we are born only to die." It's one of the interesting aspects to that story, and I saw many say that that was a pretty boring novel, which I totally disagree with, not at all for me, personally. I thought it was particularly interesting to see a Kriegsman struggle with the concept of duty and identity, to understand that while he could be something more and have greater impact beyond basic duty, ultimately, he would see that their anonymous nature is what makes them so powerful. However, the key thing to remember is that this is highly specific to the Krieg, not so much Cadians, Mordians, the Steel Legion. For those regiments, very much, names and deeds endure. Inspiration is how they empower. Yarrick is this mythical figure, even among his enemies, but he was above all else always just a man. But he wasn't born to that name. He was born Sebastian, or Baz, Varden, on the world of Taos III. Orphaned and raised by his tough but caring grandfather, who himself was a veteran sergeant of the Imperial Guard, it was from him that Baz would learn the skills that would save his life and bring him to the point which saw him enter the Schola. For when orcs invaded the world, his grandfather would be killed, Varden would survive long enough that when Imperial reinforcements arrived, they would find the boy. A commissar recognizing this achievement in survival took him away, but upon inquiring to his name, Sebastian chose not his own name, but the name etched upon the blade he carried, Yarrick, in honour of his grandfather. From there, he was raised in the Schola Progenium, sharpened by his shortcomings, later forged in war. Because from the outset, Yarrick had grit and bitter determination, that much was clear. But he also had this guttural stubbornness that defines the guard, that refuses to let humanity fall. When the weight of a collapsing hive world bore down on Armageddon, it was Yarrick who stood, with a burning willpower and presence that even terrified the orc masses. And yet now, a figure who was so practical and tangible lies buried beneath layers of Imperial propaganda. The words of the Ecclesiarchy, the living embodiment of the Emperor's wrath. They depict him standing tall even in his old age, his bionic claw raised to strike, his eye glowing with holy fire. They speak of his endless crusades against the war boss, sermons delivered between battles, miracles wrought by sheer defiance. How much of that is true? Knowing the Imperium, very little. But it does the job. It inspires the hope and will which fuels and drives the masses of humanity that they need to survive. When you strip away the propaganda, what remains is far more compelling. A tired old man, a loyal servant, someone who saw the Imperium not for what it claimed to be, but for what it had to be. Brutal and unyielding. The seed of this unbreakable will was planted early in the sterile, pitiless halls of the Schola, where orphans of war and the nobility and planetary casualties alike were fed into the Imperial machine, and what emerged were the Commissars, the Judges, the Tempestus, the Sororitas, the Assassins, sometimes even servants for the Inquisition. Those who kept the Imperium's lower ranks functioning, essentially, through their brutal discipline, their indoctrinated loyalty, and their merciless executions. The Schola taught, weakness was heresy, mercy was a luxury no longer afforded to humanity. And from that edifice emerged Yarrick. What he had taken away from his time spent there was more dangerous than simple obedience. He developed an unwavering sense of clarity. Because by then he knew what the Imperium was, its history, the decay behind the mask and the facade. Instead of recoiling from the horror, though, he embraced what was necessary. He did not believe the Emperor to be a god because he was told to. He believed it because a species on the brink of extinction needs something unquestionable, a singular, blinding star to guide its crumbling arc. For Yarrick, the Emperor was less a divine father and more a pillar, something which could not be permitted to fall, even if the rest of the Imperium turned to ash. Very likely, whatever the Emperor actually is after 10,000 years, that sentiment is quite correct. And whether the Emperor is a god or not, it's pretty critical to understand that ideological perspective, and Gilliman would agree very likely with Yarrick just as much. So he was trained by the Schola in the art of the Tempestus, the warriors. Yarrick's early service was poorly recorded, largely because it was unremarkable, not for lack of distinction, but because he had not yet become the figure history demanded. For there are thousands, if not millions, of Imperial officers who serve with distinction. Few would become memorable enough or live long enough that any could really know their name, though. While Yarrick served in regiments on distant worlds, putting down uprisings, purging the impure, all sort of standard fare, because I'll say it again, remember the Guard and the Sororitas of the Imperium spend far more time suppressing human disruption than they do Xenos horror. But by the time of Armageddon, Yarrick had a lot of experience under his belt. He had time to forge and understand his own perspective. He led the Steel Legion a century prior to the Second War on Armageddon. And Yarrick by then was ruthless, but not monstrous. He had a clear purpose to his severity. Execute cowards, not the wounded. Punish disorder, but not despair. These kind of small distinctions don't go unnoticed by the masses. And so his sense of reputation would grow. It made him respected rather than just feared. But respect did not make him immune to doubt. There are hints, fragments, that suggest Yarrick wrestled with the cost of the Imperium's eternal war. He saw the endless tide of youth thrown into the meat grinder, regiments used like sandbags to just hold a crumbling front. By the time of Armageddon, he understood the hypocrisy of commanders who cloaked their cowardice in piety, and the Inquisitors who rewrote failure into parable. He would not be the first or the last to have such contemplations, and yet he did not turn away nor rebel as we have seen others might. But there is a crucial moment, a turning point, before the great wars of Armageddon, when Yarak chose to lean into that image. He began to understand that survival in the 41st millennium was not just about weapons or manpower or armor even. It was about harnessing the tool that could unlock the greater power of humanity, perception. Because to defeat an enemy like the Orc, who thrived on momentum and belief, you had to become more than just a man. Yarak understood that truth in the Imperium was very much a luxury, and that sometimes a well-told lie might save a city, a regiment, a world. So by the time his name was spoken on the wind itself, with every act of his brutal faith, every sermon of war, every corpse stepped over, Yarak buried that man that he had once been. He would become, in that place, something colder, sterner, still human, but in a different sense. He was a figure of necessity. This burden is what elevates him above the propaganda statues, the parade ground oaths. He bore the cost of survival, not because he was forced to, but because he saw that nobody else would survive long enough to do it if he did not. And that's really the simple origins of Yarak, that before the myth and the legend, before the claw and the eye, there was just a boy, a man, unwavering, morally questioning even, but would remain deeply pragmatic. A human who looked into the abyss and chose to become the fear they saw inside. By the outbreak of the Second War for Armageddon, he knew exactly who he was. Commissar Sebastian Yarak. But at this point, he was already old, tired, felt he had seen everything the Imperium would need to offer him, and felt his service was done. He was very wrong. Now, comically, new material about the First War for Armageddon just released, and wouldn't you know it, it arrived today whilst I'm in the middle of editing this. But this video is really about Yarak and his influence rather than the narrative breakdown of the Armageddon Wars, so today we will give an overview of that, but really what binds it all together is Yarak. And I think if I do a more deeper sort of breakthrough analysis of the entire Armageddon situation right from the beginning to the end, I'll do that a little later in a more atmospheric style. Armageddon was a world which had suffered. It was already scarred even as the first notable war broke out upon it. And that was no petty rebellion or Xenos incursion. It was this warp-born invasion led by no less than Angron, the demon primarch of the World Eaters. In this first war, the suffering was horrendous. Its surface crawled with blood-hungry berserkers and warp-spawn enemies. It was only saved by the coordinated efforts of the Grey Knights, Space Wolves, and Assassinorum. But their ultimate victory came at a typically grim price, seen throughout the Imperium when such figures arrive. That being complete secrecy. All surviving Imperial Guard and PDF who had witnessed the demons were executed or mind wiped. The truth of the war was buried, the people were told there had been a large-scale civil insurrection. It was a lie, but as we spoke about earlier, a necessary one at the time, and one which subsequently left the world unprepared for what was to come, which is, as always, very much the standard chain of events for the Imperium. There are worlds in the galaxy that, through often little fault of their own, never stop bleeding. Armageddon is one such place, positioned in the Segmentum Solar, near to the unstable warp routes of the Maelstrom. It was a long vital supplier of manpower, raw infrastructure materials, fabrication, promethium for the wider war machine. Its skies blackened by industry, its oceans sludged with toxic runoff. Its hive cities like Hell's Reach, Hades, and Acheron pierced the atmosphere like rusting spears. The population lived lives of human hardship, which were very typical. Many died young. It was a planet where their own daily war was the work they toiled in. As the scars of the First War faded into rumour, the Imperium's vigilance, of course, slackened. Their attention was redirected elsewhere. And so the perfect conditions arose for the Green Menace to fall upon the world. For this war would be led by the war boss known as Gazgul Mag Uruk Thraka, a warlord whose psychic resonance made him not just powerful, but indeed a prophet among the orcs, a living apocalypse for themselves and the Imperium. And as would be typical for any orc invasion, they descended in near inestimable numbers, making landfall across multiple zones, smashing into the planet with orcs pouring out like tidal waves, striking from orbit in their extremely crude but effective assault pods. Their ships trailed radiation and wreckage, shedding entire decks as they burned through the upper atmosphere, which is always a vision of the orcs that I absolutely love. Their ships just kind of disintegrating as they smash into our planet. It's just spectacular. The furious conflagration which erupted on the planet thereafter would see one hive city, Volcanus, wiped off the map within days. This was a tsunami of orc power that just decimated anything in its path. Commissar Yarak at this time had already forged this reputation in the Guard for his discipline, his belief in the Emperor as this organizing principle of survival. And as noted, as a commissar, he'd basically seen the strength that ritual and faith could inspire versus the rot that cowardice spread if that was left unpunished. Nonetheless, Yarak had never faced anything like this orc invasion led by Ghazghal, and just some discipline was not going to be enough to survive it. As is standard for these campaigns, the planetary overlord was ignorant and hapless, and so when Yarak pragmatically ordered an astropathic distress call against the wishes of the planetary overlord, he would be assigned to Hive Hades, or perhaps exiled might have been a better term, because despite being a key industrial hive city situated near the equatorial belt of the planet, it was typically poorly defended, undersupplied, a prime target to be overrun. Many senior commanders even believed it to be already a lost cause, and some were recommending evacuation. Yarak had clearly been sent there to die. Yet he refused to accept this impending annihilation. Instead, he got to work. He consolidated the PDF and other Guard units. He purged any and all who were being defeatist or deserting, executions and the like. His will was absolute, and certainly in this instance it was through fear, this capacity to instill dread in the units he commanded, that would come to define this engagement. Because when the orc hordes finally reached the city, they found not a crumbling hive, but a fortress, which of course made near to zero impact about how the orcs chose to approach and engage with it. But Yarak had transformed Hades into a bastion of resistance. Trenches had been dug, turrets reactivated, walls reinforced, and so when the siege began, it was no less than had been expected. It was apocalyptic. The orcs struck with characteristic madness. Just about any contraption they had came falling from the sky, trundling battle fortresses rolling forward, spewing fire and smoke and guns. There were stompers, there were teeming mobs of boys and knobs. It was a brutal engagement. Entire districts were flattened, lines overrun, immense infrastructure and imperial damage. But they still held on. Yarak was not simply a figurehead and not just a distant voice behind the lines. He was present. He visited the front line. He demanded in rousing speeches that every soul fight until death or victory. He stood atop gun lines with bolter in hand, delivering sermons that were half prayer, half threat. The siege went on and on. Yarak was wounded repeatedly. He refused surgery until after the enemy had been repelled. The orcs began to see not the usual behaviour here than they had seen with other humans. They were used to seeing the rank and file guard just ready to be chewed through. The stupid Umis never had their bosses out in the fight, and yet now they were. Yarak was visible, actively notable even to the orcs, so much so that in time they actually began to fear him. Now how much of that is actually from his own endurance and how much of it is from orcs telling each other stories is somewhat irrelevant. Because all that matters is that the orcs began to tell each other tales of a man who could not die, whose gaze burned through armour. These stories were told again and again, and more than likely embellished in typical orky fashion, so that by the time they reached Ghazghal himself, the expectations of Yarak were considerable. No matter what Ghazghal threw at Hades, the humans still resisted. They seemingly could not be defeated. And this led to the war boss becoming all but obsessed with destroying it and the man who commanded its warriors. So enraged about the defiance of Hades was Ghazghal that he sent one of his strongest war bosses, Ugalhard, to deal with Yarak's resistance. In the battle that ensued, Yarak was infamously wounded in this duel, losing his right arm with a swipe from the orc's power claw. The Commissar's iron will, though, allowed him to not only survive, but to rise up and decapitate the orc boss with his chainsword. Then, pulling the power claw from its ruined body, he held it high above him, the sight of which caused the orcs to flee in terror, while simultaneously causing the human defenders to charge forward with renewed vigour. Yarak had demonstrated his unbreakable iron will. He ordered his arm to be replaced in a moment that really defines where Yarak becomes legend, for he ordered his arm replaced not with standard Imperial augmetics, but with the power claw of the slain orc boss, a visible, grotesque trophy, but one that he understood the psychological impact that this would inflict upon the orcs. Later, when his eye was also damaged during battle, he had it replaced with a pulse laser implant, further playing on the orcs' superstitions, to where they began to speak of his evil eye that could kill with a glance. Now, just how practically functional that really was is again not really relevant, because in the context of this conflict, what really matters is what it symbolized. Yarak had become precisely what the orcs feared, and in doing so, he exacerbated and empowered it even further. He turned their own nature exponentially against them. And for him to exploit this is to demonstrate how well he understood the orcs. Because as we know, orcs are comical, but powerful in their ability where the strength of their belief defines truth. It's a reason why orcs should not be ever underestimated. Because they have this very strange gestalt orc psychic ability, that through this collective belief, if a thing is feared, it may well become real. Luckily for the orcs, that rarely happens, because they tend to not really fear anything. Luckily for the Imperium, the orcs don't tend to really understand how this power works themselves, because if it did, they could will some truly terrifying things into reality. Most of the time for orcs, it's the classic red things go faster, bigger bomb goes boom, and that's pretty good for most orcs most of the time. In this instance, the genius of Yarak was to become their fear. He was already the man who had stood up to their strongest and lived, which in itself was very disturbing to the orcs, but now he had become, in their minds, a living Umi avatar of death. That belief radiated through their ranks like a plague. They hesitated, they faltered, they were scared. So that when at last Imperial reinforcements, including Space Marines from the Salamanders and Black Templars, arrived in force, it was more than enough to turn the tide. Hades had held, but barely. It had been completely overrun by now, wave after wave of orc reinforcements that Gazgul had just thrown in. The orcs were pushed back, and Gazgul fled the system. His war was shattered, but not destroyed. Armageddon was saved, but at a horrifying cost. Pyrrhic victory does not really do it justice, for casualties across the hives numbered in the hundreds of millions. The equatorial zones were rendered uninhabitable for generations, and for the Imperium, a Pyrrhic victory is of course still salvation. The Emperor's angels saved us yet again. The humans, though, are left to look around at the oceans of dead and burning hive cities as they watch the Emperor's Astartes roar off into the void in their Thunderhawks, while the masses grind back to rebuilding and cremating the dead. Of course, in the eyes of the Imperium, to just survive is not enough. The orcs who had survived were still out there, and this alone was unfinished work. Yarak understood this in a way that few mortals ever do. He saw that becoming a legend required more than just raw courage and action, it required narrative. His power claw wasn't just a practical defiance, it was a real sense of theatre. And the second war led by Gazgul was surely only Act 1. Myth had taken root, and Yarak knew he could never lay it down now, not until Gazgul lay dead. Wars against the Orc were often spoken of as being eternal, and now so was he. Yarak declined all attempts to remove him from service. He had seen the devastation Gazgul had unleashed, and personally he felt the weight of that presence. He knew with terrible certainty that despite what others were claiming, the war was most certainly not over. The orcs had fled, but they were not destroyed. and orcs love nothing more than to return to have another go. So until that final reckoning, Yarak could not cease. Armageddon revealed what the Imperium could rarely choose to admit, that even in a galaxy of demigods and angels, what saved humanity was not divinity, but human persistence. Yarak didn't win the war through superior strength or holy power, he just turned the battle through his own bitter endurance and the transfer of that to the men under his command. He made that endurance his weapon. He became what the orcs believed he was. He became their fear. Yarak achieved what seemingly no others could have, and in doing so, he became a legend. The victory on Armageddon should have been the end of it. But in the galaxy of the Imperium, victory is not peace, merely permission for further suffering. And so instead of rest, Yarak was canonized in living flesh. He was no longer just a commissar, he had become something else entirely, a weapon of morale, a walking relic, an icon bound in iron and discipline. The High Lords of Terror recognized his value. The Munitorum flooded Segmentum propaganda networks with stories of the stand at Hades, embellished for maximal psychological yield. These stories, the officially sanctioned exaggerations, were distributed across regimental briefings, minister on pulp sermons, even education texts in fringe systems. The Imperium founded had something for the populations to believe in. The man, Yarak, the Imperial Commissar, broken, battered, surviving, winning against all odds. It was perfect. He was offered elevation beyond rank, positions of strategic command, ceremonial governance, cushioned retirement. He refused them all. He chose to remain active in his duties, for he did not believe he had earned rest while Ghazghal still breathed. He also knew, seemingly in a way that many Imperial heroes did not, that to become a symbol is to enter a prison from which there is no parole. As long as he lived, the mask could not come off. In death, he should become a martyr and empower humanity eternal. That was his ultimate fate. Which again is one reason why I say death by old age is absolutely insane and a disgrace, because it undermines the very core purpose that Yarak himself had set upon. In this period, between the Second and Third Wars for Armageddon, likely because less happened, it's not so documented, but it's certainly rich in speculative psychological detail. There is, of course, the Golgotha campaign, but I feel like that's not really strictly necessary to flesh out here, beyond noting the existence of his personal Baneblade, the Fortress of Arrogance. For really what's important is how Yarak became this figure of renown, somewhere between a respected officer and a saint. And as I say, with the release of this new Armageddon material, I really should do a nice atmospheric narrative piece, a linear storyline through, so that's something to do. But I think Yarak was cautious of what he had become now. He doesn't strike me as a figure that would ever have asked for worship. He was certainly not one who would have been blind to the benefits of becoming this myth either. But I'm sure that he could also see the damage that was being caused when men believed too easily in idols or cultish worship of figures who were not deserving of it. Because when faith substituted logical conclusions or just base critical thinking, then disaster and collapse was never far away. The orcs too had not forgotten him. A translated orc glyph chant recounts a Humi boss who shines fire from his face and steals strength from death. And orcs are just known to carry trophies or icons of things they believe in, and so one could well imagine to see the orcs carrying crude bionic eyes on chains as trophies, wanting their weapon upgrades to include claws, somehow believing this granted luck or a share of Yarak's power. Because again, many orcs really saw Yarak as kind of like an honorary orc. That's not an unusual thing, we've seen that on other planets as well, where if humans lean in enough towards the orcs, orcs kind of start to see them as an orc. I can imagine entire orc clans doing sort of mock duel theatre, where their war boss killed the Umi with the claw to prove somehow some sort of worthiness. For Ghazghal though, Yarak was most certainly, by now, more than just an opponent. He was proof that the war could not rest, proof that the Umis had champions strong enough to be challenged, to be destroyed. Ghazghal spoke of Yarak often, even reverently. He often would talk of Yarak as who he was going to give a good crumping to, and a need to finish the job. He wasn't seeking to crush Yarek to just end the war. He wanted him alive again and again, because their personal battle now was the war. Without Yarek, there was no worthy enemy, no meaning to the slaughter. On the other side of the coin, Yarek gave the Imperium a face to believe in. So began this strange paradox that played out in Blood and Iron, two enemies who could not kill each other because doing so would end the purpose they served. In a bizarre turn of fate, their dependency became self-perpetuating through endless, unfinished war. Yarek had weaponized his own body to break Orc morale, and now the Orcs carried him forward as a myth they not only feared, but revered and refused to allow to die. It's tempting to call this chapter of Yarek's life a tragic one, and in truth, there is tragedy, but not the clean tragedy of failure. It's the slow erosion of self beneath these layers of expectation. Yarek could no longer count on himself just being effective. He had to be invincible. Nothing else would suffice or satisfy anyone. His very presence was expected to shift battlefield outcomes, inspire last stands, break sieges. This even led to several guard regiments deployed alongside Yarek suffering catastrophic morale loss, not because they were losing, but because he had been silent during a bombardment and his presumed death had shattered their belief. And that's very much the danger with such celestial figures, that while they live, they inspire and empower. In death, the damage or the benefit of the collapse of morale could be far, far worse. Now, Yarek didn't die. He survived, of course. There are many instances of his rumoured demises. But the lesson really overall is that the myth of Yarek was now out of control. I think for me, the interesting idea about Yarek before going into the third war for Armageddon is really this idea of, is Yarek really still fighting for victory? Or had he begun to fight just in the guise of what he had now become, because there was no other version of himself left? Strangely, he had kind of become like Gazgul, sort of war boss mentality, where the idea, the concept of him being this bigger individual is what carried more weight than his actual practical actions. In some sense, Yarek became that cliche also of the mirror held up to the Imperium. They wanted a symbol, he gave them one. But what does that symbol do when their cause becomes endless, when every battle leads to another, when the very thing you oppose refuses also to die? An ordinary commander, a commissar, could have just respectfully withdrawn, tactically adjusted their strategy. In time, maybe they could have accepted a commissar's desk, lived out their years training successors or doing work behind the lines. For Yarek, that was absolutely impossible. Now, Yarek was the guard. He had espoused this for so long that soldiers could never falter, never step down, only to stand. Then so must he, even when the mask no longer felt like his armour, but had become his tomb. Throughout the galaxy of the Imperium, despite the fact that in the far future there is only war, there are still wars that end. Armageddon was not one of them. So when the third war for Armageddon came, it was not at all unexpected. It was a storm long foreseen upon the horizon. The Imperium had been tracking Gazgul's movements since his flight from the Second War. Yarek had made it this personal mission, his obsession really, to trace the Warlord across the stars. Every intercepted Orc glyph, every fragment of astropathic chatter and tremor in the warp was sifted, analysed, linked back to this rising storm. On the other side, after Armageddon, Gazgul had watched from the shadows. He'd studied the Imperium and D'Umis. He needed to know better how to combat them. The battle for Hive Hades had not broken him, and what the Imperium mistook for retreat was more like preparation, which is very typical for the Orcs. In the years that followed, Gazgul unleashed a series of precision raids, not the usual Orc brawling, but more cold, calculated strikes. Imperial bases were destroyed without warning. Patrol fleets vanished. Entire systems reported attacks only after their vox signals went silent. He kept his name out of it, testing their responses, watching humans scramble without knowing who they faced. Guerrilla commando campaigns left worlds in ruins. Every strike served a purpose, though. Every loss taught a new lesson. Eventually, the time was right for the return, but not alone. With the warlord Nazdreg at his side, together they launched an assault on Piscina 4 using a new weapon, a teleporter system. This was built into a space hulk. The device worked, and that was the final piece he needed in his puzzle to assault Armageddon. The next war would be nothing like the last. So when they eventually returned at Armageddon, Ghazghal was not as a warlord, but more a prophet of Gork and Mork. Not simply a leader of warbands, he now carried an aura of Orkness, a figure revered by orcs across entire sectors. The green tide that descended was like a second coming of Gork and Mork. In the aftermath of the first invasion, the Imperium had also launched a vast reconstruction of the Armageddon system. Recognizing its strategic value finally, the Adeptus Terror had ordered significant naval upgrades, the notable St. Jiren's Dock was rebuilt to support interstellar warships, three permanent monitoring stations were installed in the outer system, Mannheim, Dante, and Yarrick, after the heroes of the Second War, ground and orbital defenses were completely overhauled, and though immense effort was made, progress was still slow. So much that even after 50 years, much remained incomplete due to rising demands elsewhere in the Imperium. And that's always an issue with the Imperium, is its need to prioritise current problems, which then inevitably trickles down to creating bigger issues elsewhere later. The number of available regiments declined, weakening Armageddon's long-term security. A military council was appointed, led by General Kurov of the Imperial Guard, and supported by high-ranking representatives from the Navy, the Minotaurum, the Ecclesiarchy, the Mechanicus. Across a 25-year period, Kurov oversaw xenocidal campaigns in the jungles and across key regions that purged the enduring orc infestations. But even as the Imperium rebuilt, the orcs now returned. Attacks on nearby systems continued to escalate, astropathic messages had flooded in, there were visions of blood, destruction, the beast resurgent, rumours that Ghazghal had already returned, and even the most obstinate bureaucrats could no longer deny the reality that was bearing down upon them. A new war was coming, and it seemed inevitable that Armageddon would burn again. And alongside that expectation, Commissar Yarrick returned. He had not grown softer with age, if anything the years had made him more exact, more silent, more formidable. His presence on the battlefield during the Third War was noted across multiple war zones. Not because he commanded directly, but because wherever he stood, resistance hardened. His pursuit of Ghazghal had become something more than vengeance, more than duty. It had become a metaphysical campaign. Because to Yarrick, Ghazghal was not just a war boss. He was the embodiment of the Imperium's greatest fear, that no matter how many enemies it slays, the void will just bring new ones. To slay Ghazghal was to prove that persistence could defeat this sense of inevitability. It was, in essence, a war of meaning. On the day of the Emperor's ascension, 57 years after the previous invasion, the orcs returned. Ghazghal's force would once again descend on Armageddon. The first sign of this, though, was silence. Monitor Station Dante was cut off mid-transmission. Within hours, hundreds of orc ships emerged. Final reports confirmed at least 50 cruisers, 300 escorts, and multiple space hulks. The system went to full alert. Cruiser squadrons, including His Will and Triumph, deployed immediately. Despite the Imperial Navy fighting extremely hard, destroying dozens of orc ships, they were outnumbered 6-1. The orc vessels attacked in waves, completely heedless of their losses. They pushed through, and Triumph was soon overwhelmed by five orc flotillas crippled by massed fire. Facing ultimate encirclement and destruction, they ordered a retreat. The monitor stations were lost within hours. Over 2,000 orc ships and a dozen space hulks overwhelmed Imperial defences in the largest Xenos fleet assault recorded in history. The surviving ships could only conduct harrowing raids as the orcs took control of the entire system. Strange asteroid fortresses and weapons platforms were encountered to the rear of the orc fleets. They were very slow, heavily armed, and unlike anything seen before. Their presence alone suggested a strategic, deeper purpose. Rather than striking the dock directly, the orcs unusually besieged it for 6 days. Boarding waves finally would breach the station, much of it wrecked before inquisitorial kill teams eventually drove them out. In the final weeks before the most direct of Ghazghal's landings, Armageddon was now consumed by a frenzy of preparation. Titan legions reactivated their ancient reactors, Imperial Guard regiments were entrenched, and Space Marines from over 20 chapters deployed to hold the line. In orbit, Imperial ships ran a gauntlet of Orc patrols to deliver their reinforcements. Amidst it all, Yarak had returned, stepping once more onto the ashes of Hive Hades, to the immense cheers and adulation of the population. The myth of Yarak preceded him. He took immediate command of the military council, warning of Ghazghal's cunning and scale, his presence alone carrying a resolve within those who remembered the last war. General Kurov handed him operational control. 6 weeks after Ghazghal's forces had entered the system, the Orc fleet fully committed. Massive warships and hulks moved into high orbit. Armageddon's orbital defences, long hoped to hold the line, were just overwhelmed. And after a brutal 3-day bombardment, the skies rained fire. Hades was struck by waves of incandescent meteors as Orc assault pods tore down through the upper atmosphere. By now, Yarak was on the ground, ordering the last of the Imperial Air Forces into a desperate counterstrike, sacrificing their aircraft in a final bid to destroy as many Orc landers as were possible before they reached the surface. The landings were just devastating. The Orcs came down in massive columns, huge mobs, walkers, war machines. They teleported directly into combat as Imperial gunlines strained to hold. Some Orc machines were lost, but many broke through. The skies were filled with dogfights, thunderbolts and furies, dueled fighter bombers in their sulfur-yellow air. The Orcs on the ground surged forward. Much like the previous war, just days after the landings, Hive cities began to fall. This time, it was Acheron. Orcs, aided by sabotage and treachery, stormed the city, and rumours swirled of blocked tunnels, failed power grids, and traitors in their midst. Then came the truth. Hermann von Straub, the incompetent, disgraced former planetary governor from the Second War of Armageddon, had incomprehensibly returned. He declared himself ruler again, under Orc protection, and crushed dissenters with his brute squads. The nobility of Acheron welcomed him back like a prodigal king. It was a betrayal laced with sheer treachery. In the east, Volcanus Hive had come under siege the same day that Acheron fell. In the ash wastes beyond, the titans of Tempestus and Victorum duelled the Orc Blackfire tribe for days amid the open desert, buying time but paying in sacred steel. Orc attacks came in waves, breaking, regrouping with a terrifying speed. Even failed assaults bled the defenders thin. Yarak moved through the lines, easily identifying Ghazghal's strategy to divide and disorientate the defenders, then strike whatever resistance was weakest. The Orcs coordinated their landings with a surprising level of clarity and concentrated their warbands with disturbing levels of precision. In many areas, only the Astartes held firm, even pushing out to launch search and destroy missions across the heartlands, eradicating Orc supply chains and the regrouping mobs before they could strike again. But Yarak understood what few others were willing to admit. This wasn't a war of conquest, it was a reckoning. Ghazghal had returned not to just fight, he had come to end it. Throughout the Third War, Ghazghal and Yarak moved in orbit of each other, never quite meeting, always influencing the flow of the war. Their campaigns mirrored each other. Ghazghal's forces surged, Yarak's countered. Hive after hive were torn open, reforged in this crucible. It was as though the entire planet was being rewritten around the gravitational pull of two opposing legends. And the psychological effect of Yarak's presence in the Third War was very profound. Orc warbands that had suffered at Hades in the previous war broke rank upon identifying his personal banner. Other Orcs fanatically loyal to Ghazghal surged towards his position like pilgrims seeking martyrdom. Yarak had become both the bane and beacon of the war. He was not just an adversary, he was the proof of the Orc god's wrath. The final test. Despite his symbolic status, Yarak did not command from Realize. He was out there from the wreckage of his personal Baneblade, his power claw covered in gore, his command style more surgical, appearing where morale was needed, where losses were turning fatal, where commanders were cracking. As the war deepened, Ghazghal unleashed his full arsenal. Orc submersibles landed at Tempestora and Hell's Reach. They bypassed Imperial defences. Within days, the city fell, and Hell's Reach docks were overrun, despite desperate resistance from stormtroopers and Astartes. Ghazghal's infamous rocks, armoured asteroids now retrofitted with weapons, shields and teleport arrays, had become flying fortresses, delivering Orc reinforcements directly into battle with the teleporters. Yarak led a counterattack against these, supported by Legio Metallica, successfully destroying several. Yet the cost of doing so was unacceptably high. Elsewhere, entire regiments were wiped out in hours as Orc warbands surged into Imperial territory. The first major ground engagement came at a factory complex where Gargants under warlords Burzuk and Scarfang clashed with the Titans of Crucius. 6 Titans and 8 Gargants were lost, as was the site itself. Its facilities were entirely torn apart by the Orcs to fuel their further conquest. And when Hive Infernus came under siege, Orc speed cults isolated it completely. Counterattacks failed. Its populace tried to take inspiration from the legends of Commissar Yarak and how he had made the Orcs pay for every inch of ground at Hades. Not all were brave enough to face their doom. Thousands fled into the wastes to be killed or captured by the speed cults, which circled the Hive like vultures. Within days, any defenders were trapped, shelled, and slaughtered. To the north and south, fresh Orc landings in the fire wastes and deadlands shattered Imperial commanders. The Imperium's morale faltered. Infernus burned beneath orbital bombardment, and its defenders made their peace. Then came a final message delivered by Colonel Gortar. Their final choice: surrender or die. And the war was only getting started. Elsewhere, in the poisoned light of Ghatanna Bay, where the air reeked of coolant and burning promethium, each side sought to deliver a decisive blow. The Orcs had launched an aggressive assault to the key water processing facility here that sustained the Hades districts. They had thrown everything into the battle. Orc dreadnoughts thundered forward, hammering Imperial trenches with the rockets and saw blades. The defenders braced for a quick collapse. But as the smoke of the battlefield parted, a wall of giants stood. Imperial giants. 17 venerable dreadnoughts. The ancient dead entombed in ceramite and hate, waiting for the Orc filth. At their head stood Brother Deimos, who gave no warning as their las cannons opened fire. Within seconds, the first rank of Orc walkers were reduced to flame and scrap. They kept coming. 400 meters of exposed advance were under a punishing fire. The Orcs paid for every inch. 17 machines were lost before they even reached striking distance, and as the Orcs crashed against them in a bellowing tide, Deimos and his brothers did not yield. The bottleneck thickened. The Space Marine dreadnoughts launched their counter-assault, plowing into the mass of scrap metal beasts with autocannon and close combat savagery. Steadily, the Orc dreadnoughts fell, but none fled. Not a single one turned away, but none would survive. Their gambit had failed. Their final reserves gone, Thunderhawks began their strafing runs. The Orcs had no choice but to withdraw, and the Imperials once again held the line. But the cost was written in shattered ancient Astartes hulls and scorched ground. This marked the point to where this war entered a new phase: stagnation. Despite the overwhelming material firepower, Ghazghal had become ever impatient with the deadlock. Quite simply, he had become bored. The stalemate between himself and Yarak no longer amused him, and so in the twisted way of the Prophet Warrior, he enacted a personal revelation. He would resurrect Makari, his luckless standard bearer, and for the first time spoke to the Grot not just as his mascot, but as something more of an equal. Ghazghal, in his own brutal dialect, confessed that he hadn't been wrong, not weak, of course, but just mistaken. He had created a great war on Armageddon, but saw now it could be more. As if in answer to that pondering, a Lehman Russ battle tank emerged from the dust to blast a shell straight into the war boss's chest. Gaskell fell, but Makari did not, the Grot crawling inside the tank to murder the crew. And when Gaskell eventually awoke scorched and bleeding, he didn't see a defeat, but he saw Mork or Gork had intervened and selected for him to leave. Gaskell declared the beginning of a new campaign, the Great War, and handed Armageddon to his lieutenants, for there was more galaxy to burn. Yarak, though, learning of Gaskell's departure, made the fateful decision with a detachment of Black Templars to leave also in pursuit. His fate, he saw it, was inextricably linked to Gaskell, and their trail led to the Battle of Haunted Gulf, where Yarak came close to finishing the job, but Gaskell escaped again, laughing as he vanished off into the stars. On Armageddon, the war did not end. Instead, the planet continued to burn. The Orcs now renamed it the Big Scrap, or in the darker corners, Ragnarok, the final Orc battle. More greenskins poured into the system every day, drawn by the scent of the endless battle. The casualty counts spiraled to the billions, hives collapsed, rivers ran black with ash. Death became a currency, and the cost of it written on every page of every regiment's ledger. There are valid questions to be asked when a world reaches this point as to if it is truly worthwhile to defend, but the Imperium somehow held. Armageddon must not fall. And this was Yarak's final crusade. We lose track of him really after this time, where he departed Armageddon and began this galactic pursuit of the Prophet of the War. Details of his exploits are scattered, they're in flashes. It's possible he fought in the Octarius region, hunting Orc fleets from Charadon to the borders of the Ghoul Stars. Not in conquest, but for just some sense of conclusion. But what makes his pursuit of Gaskell remarkable is its lack of spectacle. It's entirely possible, and this is my speculation, that he refused to allow the Munitorum to document his victories, because now he was not waging war for the greater morale, but for his own purposes, to keep a promise forged in blood at Hades decades earlier, a promise that he would see Gaskell dead. Now, as I said at the beginning, for me what this is really all about is that there has been no resolution. Whether he died fighting or lives in the shadows, Yarak achieved what few ever could. In becoming inseparable from the war, he stood against Gaskell, and so long as the war continued, then so did his legend. So it makes no sense at all for the Imperium to just declare him dead, because even if the man has gone, his strength of character and symbolism would live on forever. It's kind of like Marbo a little bit. The Ecclesiarchy could surely see the value there. Essentially, even if Yarak were dead, I can't see that the Imperium would want to admit it, because through his absence, the legend would grow. Symbols once buried become consigned to their fate, but if they're left unconfirmed, they remain alive, kind of like Dawn. There's a reason to believe that the Imperium chose ambiguity deliberately. The Departmento Munitorum has long known that morale hinges not on truth, but on perception. Comically, the Orcs too have helped to perpetuate this uncertainty. Some warbands claim that Gaskell slew him in battle and kept his skull as a relic. Others believe Yarak escaped and stalks the void, waiting for a rematch. In the campaigns that followed from Vigilus to Charadon and Octarius, commanders invoked Yarak's name, his sermons, his quotes, his speeches, especially those among Armageddon's command echelons, the Steel Legion, all remain powerful to those who receive them. And that's because the Orcs are never truly gone. And whilst it remains comical that very likely they remember him with greater accuracy than does the Imperium, for they don't paint him as some kind of saint or martyr, they remember him as a big Umi boss who could not die. A figure whose eye burned like the sun and whose claw cracked Orc skulls. Their warbands carve crude Yarak glyphs into their armour. Some mega-armoured knobs fashion their stylized iron claws in mimicry. Yarak's legacy is to make that great green enemy afraid to forget him. And in so doing, he remains eternal. In doctrine, in deployment, in memory, he's not alive but not buried. He's a spectre in every commissar's shadow, a story whispered at night by guardsmen stationed in the outer dark. The collective memory of a man who endured beyond, who bore Xenos symbols not for glory, but because it was necessary. That great sense of duty without end. And of course, there remains the bizarre, speculative possibility that even if Yarrick died, would the orcs resurrect him through their belief alone? Has Yarrick inexplicably unlocked the key to true immortality? It's very possible. And this is finally the crux of my entire argument, that to declare Yarrick dead off-screen is such an immense disgrace for such a unique character. Because Yarrick was about much more than a single victory or battle or campaign. Yarrick is about presence. Where he stood, the line was held. It's really as simple as that. No grand victory, no final revelation. Just that he stood, and where he did, so did the guardsmen alongside him. To me, that is the definition of humanity in M41.